This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We're learning more about the impact of a series of tornadoes that hammered the Miami Valley earlier this week. The size and scope of some of these storms have many people feeling lucky to be alive. So what's left behind and what's next? We begin the Friday News Review with WYSO 91.3 Morning Edition host and reporter April Leslie. Welcome, April. WYSO Webmaster Programming Coordinator and Deputy Operations Manager Juliet Fromhold. Welcome, Juliet.
Thank you.
Cincinnati Inquirer Director of Photography for Ohio, Kara Owsley, is in the studio with us. Welcome, Kara.
Thank you.
And WVXU reporter and all things considered host Bill Reinhart, also in the studio. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you.
If you have questions for our list of journalists today related to the tornadoes that hit the Miami Valley this week, call us 513-419-7100. You can also email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets. Before we get to this conversation, I want to set the scene for the listeners who may not fully understand the scope of these things. WCPO covered some of the National Weather Service information that was released about the size and scope of these tornadoes, noting that the Brookville, Trotwood, Dayton, Riverside tornado went 19 miles. It traveled 19 miles. And to put that into perspective, WCPO noted that that's like driving from Walton, Kentucky to downtown Cincinnati. This particular tornado was more than half a mile wide. They say that's 10 football fields wide, very, very large. West Milton tornado traveled almost 11 miles on the ground. Very large tornadoes hammered this area. Let's hear a piece of audio from some earlier reporting.
And I could literally see when the tornado blew through because it was super calm and then it was just super crazy as it blew through. And actually on my street, half the houses on my street are probably going to have to be torn down and rebuilt. Like, it literally came down the street I live on, ripped up most of the houses. And I live in a very low dip gully right down by a creek. And for whatever reason, man, it skipped over my house and a few other houses on the street. I'm not the only one who was lucky, but it's crazy how just random the tornado picked houses. It had one house here, three houses down, completely destroyed, then a house across the street destroyed, just randomly picking houses to be destroyed. So the fact that I didn't have anything destroyed up there and nothing destroyed up my business here, I mean, I'm super thankful, super thankful.
If you've seen any of the images from the damage across the Miami Valley, you know that he's not mistaken, that some houses were completely destroyed and others just seem to be randomly skipped. We're going to talk a little bit about what some of the observers on the scene have witnessed, but let's just get caught up on what the latest is. April, this was a pretty tough week for your part of the region. Why don't you tell us where things stand now?
So right now we have over 10,000 people still without power. That is a big improvement. We started with like 60,000 people without power. Much of the region has also had water service restored. That was a critical issue directly after the storms. The city of Dayton and much of Montgomery County lost water service. And after it was restored, they're still under a boil order, and some people are still under a boil order there. Right now the focus is really on cleanup. There was just so much debris, it's really impossible to put into words how bad everything looked directly afterward. It still looks devastating. There are still piles of wood that used to be power poles in the middle of streets. So people are trying to figure out, you know, what to do next.
How are people in general? What is this their general feeling about what they've gone through?
I would say traumatized at this point. I mean, I talked to some people who were mostly spared. Their houses are missing roofs, but compared to what some of their neighbors experienced, at least they have walls that are still standing. And I asked, you know, how are you guys feeling and how did it feel at the time? And they just said terrified. That was it. They were absolutely terrified.
Juliet, when we talk about the path of destruction, those are words. The images are really quite shocking. Can you put into geographic sense just how widespread this was?
We had multiple tornadoes in the same night, which is something that's very unusual for this area. And we're looking at a large swath of northern Montgomery County stretching from the west of the county, Brookville, which is almost along the Indiana border, all the way across the county into Greene County, where we are here at WISO. toward the Fairfield Mall. So that is a huge expanse of a highly populated area stretching across multiple cities and municipalities.
April, early in the reporting on this particular story, there seemed to be some mixed reaction to the efficacy of the warning system. And I'm curious what we know now compared to what we know then. Has there been any further criticism or any explanation about how that system worked?
So in the beginning, people were wondering in Dayton, you know, why didn't I hear sirens? And there was some confusion about that. It turns out the city of Dayton doesn't have sirens. A few years ago, they decided to get rid of the system because it was too expensive. And we're doing some work now to figure out, you know, which municipalities in the area have invested in these siren systems. They are expensive and the maintenance is expensive. So Beaver Creek, for example, which is another city that was hit hard by an EF3, they also don't have a tornado siren system. So people were alerted through their phones and the news media. And that was, as you can see by some of the injury and fatality totals, it seems like it was pretty effective. We only had one fatality. And I can tell you, when you see the destruction here, that is shocking. It seems like it should have been a lot worse.
There seemed to be some surprise here in the studio when we heard you say that there aren't sirens in Dayton or Beaver Creek.
Mm-hmm.
What system do they use then?
Well, from what I understand, it's emergency alerts on phones. That was the main way people got information, and also through our local TV stations. But there are no sirens in Dayton.
And so there must not be any federal regulations that require these sort of items. This is a municipal decision?
Yes, and we're looking into that now. As you know, in the coming days, that's something that we're going to focus on.
Sure, and since you're probably in the early parts of that reporting, I won't go too deep into that, but do you know offhand when they decided that this was too expensive and they wanted to get rid of them?
I'm actually not sure.
Okay, no idea yet on what that cost was?
Still tallying that up.
Yeah, okay. 513-419-7100 is the number to call. Another tornado that hit northeast Montgomery County traveled 7.6 miles on the ground. This crossed I-75 in northeastern Montgomery County. This was an EF2 tornado late on Monday night. One in Phillipsburg traveled 3 miles. So, Juliet, you know, thinking of a tornado blowing through town is scary enough, but to understand now that these tornadoes were so large and that they traveled such a great distance, what has been the meteorological explanation about what happened? What was this dangerous system?
Well, the National Weather Service is still undergoing their storm survey. They have very quickly determined the number of storms, which keeps rising and rising, quite honestly, every time we consult with them, that number has gone up and the intensity of the storms have gone up. In terms of cause, they don't know yet. It's going to take them a little longer to really crunch the data and look at the science there and see what exactly caused this. We do know that that night in particular and this week, we've seen really, really intense storm systems across the Midwest and across Ohio. So this is obviously part of something bigger. But I think we'll have to wait for the National Weather Service to do a little more science to give us a better answer.
What do they do when they're out in the field, the National Weather Service? What type of, I don't know, what does it look like when they're out there studying what happened?
To my knowledge, they are crunching wind velocity is a big part of this, looking at damage paths to determine how wide the storm system was. We just found out this morning that the EF4 tornado, that was the one that stretched through Brookville, Trotwood, and northern Montgomery County. It was an EF4. It traveled 19 miles. The winds were up to 170 miles per hour, and it was about a half a mile wide. And the way that they're determining that is looking at the damage path, looking at trees, at the pattern of the trees, the way they've fallen. And then, of course, the National Weather Service and local meteorological organizations have monitoring stations throughout the Miami Valley. So they're combining all of that data from the various TV stations, the monitoring stations, the storm spotters that work on TV radio, kind of the unsung heroes of all of this. And they're putting all of that together to get a complete picture of this storm.
513-419-7100 is the number to call to join this conversation. We are talking right now with WYSO's April Leslie and Juliet Fromholt. We're also joined in the studio by Cincinnati Enquirer Director of Photography for Ohio, Kara Owsley, and WVXU reporter and all things considered host, Bill Reinhardt. Kara, this happened late at night at first. And so right away, people understood that the situation was bad. But when the sun came up and you could really take in the devastation, that's when you knew something really spectacular had taken place. How do you, as a photojournalist, approach this story?
First of all, I have a really close connection to anybody who has been devastated by storms. I lost my home in Hurricane Katrina. That's how I made it to Cincinnati. So I wanted to make sure that I was a part of the coverage because I felt like I could connect to the people. So when we first got to Salina, myself and Sheila Vilvins, a reporter, it took us about 2 hours to get there. And when we first got off the highway, you see a little bit here and there. And we were kind of questioning, were we in the right location? Because we just saw a little bit debris on the side of the road. But the closer you get into the community, you start seeing stoplights out and you see police directing traffic. So when you get on the scene, when we first got to that neighborhood, you just saw community. You saw people helping neighbors, people who were not from that neighborhood, helping to clean up. So you kind of just start taking it all in. And for me, I started having little flashbacks of what I experienced. And I wanted to make sure I was really sensitive to people. I didn't walk up and just start taking their picture. I talked to the people first. And the people in Salina are very, very open. And people invite us in. They said, well, do you want to see what's left of my house? One family in particular, the Snyder family, they spent a year renovating their home. And they said they had just finished their home. But they were very adamant that we are going to rebuild. So I hope to follow them in the next few months to go back and visit them to see the progress of their home. But this family, I think at that point, it was probably 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning. I think it still really hadn't sunk in all the way of what they're going to have to deal with. That was in the back of my mind because I knew what I had to deal with. You see it, you experience, and it's like, it's a long road. But they felt very, very blessed that they were able to make it to the basement. Nobody in their family was harmed. None of their neighbors were harmed. And they just had just a short amount of time to make it to the basement when they heard. They actually had sirens, I believe. I believe they have sirens. I know they had the alerts on their phone, and they made it to the basement. So they were safe.
We spend a lot of time talking on this show, particularly on Fridays during the news review, about the situation in the city's West End with the soccer stadium coming and people concerned about losing their homes. And while that may be sad for them, there is a certain amount of time to prepare that your house is going.
Yes.
But you've experienced what these folks in Ohio experience, where it's a natural disaster and suddenly everything that you know is disrupted and gone. I know it may not be easy, but how do you put that into words about one day your house is there and the next day it's not?
Well, I would say my experience, I felt like I had it easier than tornado victims because with a hurricane, you have a little time to prepare yourself and pack up things and you can evacuate. Tornado victims don't have that at all. Can you ask me the question again?
Sorry. Sure. I just, you know, one day your home is there, the next day it's not. And what a shock that must
be. So it is a shock. And so you're just trying to deal with it the best way you can. You just like, okay, I need to find somewhere to stay. That's like the first thing. Where am I going to stay? And depending on if you have family or not. I know the victims we talked to, one family said they were not sure where they were going to stay. They did have a brother that lived in town that was helping to clean up and to try to salvage anything they could. So they said they might be able to stay there. Another family's like, we got to try to find a hotel. People were concerned about trying to wash their clothes to see if they can salvage their clothes. Because even though the one family, there was a gentleman named Kevin, and Kevin's actually from Cincinnati area, and he's been living in Salina for a while. His clothes in his drawers, his chest of drawers, he opened them up for us, and it was debris all in there. Like the insulation from the house, it was incredible. It's like, how did that get in there? And he says, I think I'm going to be able to wash my clothes. You know, that just the little things like that, they were just hoping that they would be able to do. Kevin also was happy that his car was fine. His garage didn't come down. His bedroom is a total loss. Part of their kitchen, their living room area, the guest bedrooms, completely gone. But even with him, he was just like, we're not hurt, we're fine. But, you know, I just got to try to make it do the best we can. So it's a long road. It's a really, really long road because not only you have to deal with the insurance companies, and he was waiting for the insurance company. He said, well, my insurance agent said he's going to come out. He hadn't been out here yet. And that is another long process, too.
And I imagine then there must be a series of emotions that take place. First, you have the shock of the home being gone, and then other things start to resonate with you about memories or particular items that might be lost.
Yeah, that was a woman, Mrs. Snyder. She was concerned about a plaque that she had made, and she's like, I think I can clean this up because I want to hang it back up when we get our house rebuilt. But she had a good attitude about it. You know, at that time, you're just in shock and you just can't even believe it happened. And you just try to salvage anything that you can. But the one thing that I won't forget that she said, did you go next door? They had it worse than we did. She didn't have a roof at all in her house. It was completely gone. And she seemed to be more concerned about her neighbors.
WVXU's Bill Reinhardt also went up north to check out some of the damage. And Bill, you talked to some business owners.
Yeah, I talked to a baker, and he was working Monday night when all the storms started and lost power and wasn't able to bake anything that day. And Tuesday, he gets up, goes to work, still has no power, checks in the freezer at his dough, and it's not good anymore. It's starting to, I forget the word he used, but it wasn't usable. It was just kind of melting and... He still didn't have power when I talked to him Wednesday. He was going to have to throw everything out once he did get power because he'd have to let it freeze again and then throw it out because it was a sticky mess. And he said he was going to lose several cultures, which means certain varieties of bread that he bakes that are very popular. He's not going to be able to make again for a while until he can renew those cultures. Talked to another business owner an operations manager in Old North Dayton. His place got lucky. In the back, it's a trucking company. A couple of trailers were tipped over, but the building was generally fine. A number of buildings nearby weren't so lucky. There was a nearby fire station that had been damaged but was still operational. The one thing that really stood out for me at Platinum Express was a flagpole out front had been bent over completely at a 90-degree angle at the ground level. Just metal. Metal flagpole completely bent over, flat with the ground, and still in the ground. The base of it was still in the ground. It was just
this gives you an idea
bent
of
over, yeah,
the strength
of the winds.
513-419-7100 is the number to call to join the conversation. We have Elizabeth on the line. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
What is your question or comment?
I wanted to talk about how good our Dayton forecast, our meteorologists were here. I was having a conversation with people in the office today. One woman was discussing how her family in Beaver Creek was in the basement, but at that point they had no connectivity. They lost power. The weather radio was just repeating the warning, but her sister was able to be on the phone with her, and she had Channel 7 on, and she was talking about how they were predicting street by street where the tornadoes were. And so she was telling her sister, just stay in the basement because there's one right on, you know, Fairfield Road. There's this, there's that. So that connectivity and our meteorologist was so important in helping, I think, prevent a lot more loss of life and injury.
And Elizabeth, we did see that one clip go viral. I forget which meteorologist. There he
yeah,
is. Yes. And, you know, sort of chiding some of the criticism they were getting because the affiliate had interrupted The Bachelorette or The Bachelor, whichever one is airing currently. I don't know. But yeah, he said, you know, our job is to keep people safe. Elizabeth, we appreciate your call very much. 513-419-7100 is the number. Sean is up next. Hi, Sean.
Hey, how are you doing?
We're doing well. How are you?
Doing great.
What's your question or comment?
Well, I guess on a similar vein as the previous caller, I wanted to call in with the first line of questioning about you kind of showed some shock at no sirens. And we actually were there. We were near University of Dayton. We heard faint sirens in the distance, but the phones went off multiple times. The amount of communication and the messaging that went off, the whole house phones lit up, and it was just a really, really effective system. There was a lot of extra communication. You weren't kind of wondering whether that siren was a test. You actually got very explicit details as to what went on. So I just wanted to kind of say the decision to go with the phone system was the right one in my eyes. A lot of good information. It was very effective, and it continued to update throughout the evening.
We appreciate that perspective, Sean. But before I let you go, I'm curious what time you got your first alert? Do you remember the time that you got your first alert on your phone about the coming storm?
I want to say it was right around 10:30. I know it was one of those. My first annoyance was, why are all these phones going off? And then when you look down, you're like, hey, this is something real. This is serious.
Okay, so you knew to take it seriously.
Yeah, you're concerned because you look out, and it's, as one of the earlier callers or one of the talkers had talked, it's still. There's not much outside. You can't see the storm going, but in this kind of a situation, you did feel the swirling winds, and then the calm, and then the swirling winds. And so at that point, you realize that better listen to what they're telling you. They know what they're talking about.
Sean, we appreciate the call and that perspective very much. Thanks for calling in. 513-419-7100 is the number. Let's go to Rick now. Hi, Rick.
Hey. One thing I think people really need to understand, I'm involved quite a bit with communications around emergencies. The outdoor sirens are not designed to alert you in your home, especially if you're asleep. They're okay for people that are outdoors generally, so especially for nighttime events like we just had, they're really designed just to alert people outside. You really need to have a weather radio or rely on the wireless emergency alert system that does it by cell, that passes those emergency alerts once they're issued.
Rick, we appreciate that very much. Thanks for the call. I want to go back to April and Juliet from WYSO, who are kind enough to join us on the phone today for the show. And we heard that comment about the role that the meteorologist in the Dayton market played and the important connection that people feel about the performance that they gave. April, is that the sense you're getting, or are we seeing a lot of gratitude expressed for the role the weather people played?
Yes, yes. Actually, almost everyone I talked to mentioned that, saying they felt blessed because they were able to watch television and they felt like they had been spared because they were so well informed ahead of time. There was one woman I talked to who'd been watching TV for like 2.5 hours and then finally made a decision to go to her basement when they'd forecast that it was going to hit her street, and she feels like that may have saved her life. So people are very appreciative.
Some of the people who lost power, though, was there any concern that when the TV reporting was gone that there was nowhere to turn?
I think at that point, people were warned enough that they were in their basements and safe from the immediate kind of harm there. But we did have phone alerts going off. Gosh, I felt like it was every 15 minutes or so.
Definitely.
And Juliet, as a member of the press, what are you finding in terms of the relationship that the public has with the media right now in this tragedy, this weather event, this spectacular weather event? Are people wanting to talk? Are people wanting to share their stories?
People have been generally pretty open, especially with local press. You know, they know us, they trust us, and so there's already a relationship there. I think we are seeing folks come in from, you know, outside of the region and outside of Ohio, and there's a little bit more suspicion there. However, I should add that we've had kind of a big week here in Dayton. You know, we did have a KKK rally last Saturday, and so there's been a lot of media, national media, in town already. So I think that people are a little used to having a lot of people asking questions if they've been, you know, kind of in and around the Dayton area over the past, I would say, 2 weeks leading up to this rally and then this weather event. As April said, people are very grateful to the local meteorologists as well, and seem willing to either tell their stories or just kindly say that they're not ready for that yet. I will say, though, that some people I talk to, when you're on those streets, there are people in their cars that are just taking pictures and not talking to anyone, and people are feeling a little bit victimized by that, and they're a little bit, you know, they ask people immediately when they see them, who are you and where are you coming from, because they've seen so many people that are just there to look at the damage.
I wanted to ask you specifically about that, not to go into detail about the KKK rally that took place on Saturday prior to these storms, but just the different emotions that people had to have felt between those two events, which both drew such widespread national coverage. You had such positive coverage of Dayton and the way that people sort of rose up against what so many view as a hate group. And then the national story has to change so swiftly to this event that took place. Can you, April, explain just how you, as a resident, as a journalist there, had to process that?
Well, I think, I mean, as devastating as this clearly has been, it has been encouraging because people really have come together. Before the KKK rally, there were shirts that went out that were anti-racism shirts, and they sold out almost immediately. There were several events that were organized in protest of the KKK rally. And then what we've seen in the days following the tornadoes, people want help. People have been donating water bottles and food everywhere. You see them in the disaster areas. There are cases of water stacked on almost every street corner. There are people flipping burgers in bank parking lots and giving food away to the people that are most affected. Everyone wants to get involved, and that's been really encouraging.
I want to turn back to WVXU's Bill Reinhart and the Cincinnati Inquirer's Kara Elsley here. We were talking a little bit about just some media criticism, just the objective conversation about media in general. And of course, our friends April and Juliet are based in that market. Cincinnati and Dayton are very closely associated in many ways, but technically based here, we're not the local press. So, Kara, how did you feel going into that? Did you think that just your personal experience with the loss in Hurricane Katrina was able to help you embed yourself?
Yes, it definitely did. But I'll have to say the people of Salina, they were very, very open and very friendly. The first man we tried to talk to, I noticed that he was trying to sweep up debris outside of the subdivision where he had the name of the subdivision. And I thought to me that was empowering because that was not, of course, not where he lived. And he said, my house is fine. He said, but you need to go talk to people who really lost something. And I said, okay, we will. Thank you for talking to us. And we moved on. And so the first house we got to, the Snyder family, they actually thanked us for coming. It's a small town. There's no media outlets there that I know of. And they say they never get coverage. And they were actually happy that we were there. They had no issues with us being from outside their area. They were very happy. And we got thank yous more than one time.
And Bill, was that sort of your experience as well?
Yeah. I didn't talk to a whole lot of people, but those I did, they knew Cincinnati Public Radio, so.
That's good to hear.
We're kind of local.
Our thanks to April Leslie and Juliet Fromholt from WYSO, Kara Owsley from the Cincinnati Inquirer, and WVXU's Bill Reinhart for joining us today. Appreciate the conversation to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, a look at the deal reached late Thursday between FC Cincinnati and tenants in the city's West End in the path of the new soccer stadium development plan. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The Friday News Review continues now with the latest from Cincinnati City Hall. We often call this part of the show soccer talk as we get into the stadium discussion. I'm joined today by Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge. Welcome back, Sharon.
Good to be here.
Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterick. Welcome back, Chris.
Hello.
And WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman. Jay, thanks for coming back.
Hi there.
513-419-7100 is the number to call to join us. You can email talk at wvxu.org or find us online on Facebook and Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and try to get some of those into the show as well. So you three have had some exciting times recently at the Cincinnati City Building. There's just been so much going on. And
it's one word for it.
We're digesting it every week on this show, it seems like. And yesterday, Thursday, was a pretty big day for something we've talked about consistently on here, which is that stadium that's coming in the West End and some of the tenants. Chris, what happened on Thursday?
Well, there was a kind of a lengthy city council meeting, and most of the action wasn't actually occurring in the council chamber. It was occurring in a conference room off to the side where representatives of FC Cincinnati and a group of tenants in the West End who are in housing that is now owned by the team were negotiating how they were going to basically exit that housing. And this was important to council that they strike a deal so that they're you know, so that the displacement, I suppose, that's going to happen, you know, was handled in a way that they felt was more humane than kind of what was proposed, which was, hey, May 31st, you need to kind of be gone. You know, we've given you, I think it was 80 days at least,
yeah,
to find some housing. But that's tough when you're in Section 8 housing. It's not like there is a really like large treasure trove of Section 8 housing available in the city. And so that's what that was kind of what was going on behind the scenes. And they did strike a deal. They didn't tell us much about what was in the deal. We know that they are going to get some kind of relocation payment, some moving assistance, and that they will get to stay longer than May 31st, which is, of course, today. We don't really know how much longer, though. So whatever the deal was, the tenants endorsed it, and council went ahead and passed the zoning and land sale ordinances that were needed to keep the stadium going.
So one really had nothing to do with the other, but they had these votes, and council was like, we really want to take care of these people. They're not pawns. These are their lives. You know, one of the tenants told us afterwards, he's like, you know, I just haven't been able to sleep. It's been very stressful, of course, because he doesn't know where he's going to go with this deadline of May 31st, which, yes, is today. And so we weren't there to help the tenants, but we were.
I mean, the thing that the members of council that really were focused on this issue would tell you is that the team had made a promise that they would not displace people. And I know there's been asterisks added before and after that statement was made. But nevertheless, they felt that the team should abide by, you know, what they felt were the spirit of the public statements that were made by the president of the team, Jeff Birding. And so that was why, you know, this was on the table.
And I thought it was interesting, too, that the ups and downs even just of yesterday, because there was quite a few public speakers, most of them talking about this issue, and the attorney representing the tenants, John Schreider, came in and said, I don't think we're going to get there today. We need till tomorrow, maybe even into next week. And then within, what, maybe an hour, literally there was an attorney standing just 5 or 10 more minutes, and we're going to get there. And they took a 15-20-minute recess and came in and announced that they had a deal. Again, we don't know what's in the deal. I think Chris was talking about we're not specific on timing. I think there was some speculation that it's maybe till the end of January.
That date is still true. They did say that.
Okay.
January the 31st, but
For next year?
And in that time, there was some talk that the Port Authority, or whatever it's called now, I think it's just called the Port, is going to be trying to locate some buildings that they can turn into affordable housing where these folks will be able to move once that housing is available.
So, I mean, in the past several weeks, this conversation between tenants groups and the team itself and some of the politics of City Hall had turned kind of contentious, really on all sides. People have just been flustered and upset with the pace of things and maybe the lack of progress on getting all of this settled. What were the events that led up to people agreeing finally to sit down together and hammer this out?
I think there's a lot of pressure from council to get something done and get it done. If not yesterday, then we would have been meeting today they would have been meeting today at 9:30. There was a special session of council called. One interesting thing that was mentioned publicly, and I think we've all known about it for a while, but Councilman P.G. Sittenfeld's wife is pregnant, and she is expected to deliver that baby imminently. And without him, they would not have had the 5 votes necessarily that they needed to do this. So, although everybody yesterday, once the agreement was struck and the parties endorsed it, everybody voted for it. It was unanimous. But I think that pressure that the city council was placing had a role in moving them along.
The team had pressure too, because they are 30 days out from like a stopping point on construction, because it apparently is. Go inch by inch or whatever, foot by foot. And they were getting to the entrance where they needed the rezoning. And so there was a lot of pressure on the team because there's very expensive. They actually have a contract with Major League Soccer that they will build this stadium. It was a contingency to get the expansion team, that they would have a soccer-specific stadium. That's where we are, and it needed to be basically in the urban core, right? So a lot of there's deadline pressures. That was its own fight, right? Mm-hmm. Everything has been that. And so the team was very, very worried because, I mean, how much are you going to pay these residents compared to the fines and fees of actually stopping construction? I don't know what those numbers are. It is a private entity. And so I think there was a lot of, you know, looking at those numbers to make yesterday happen.
Right. I mean, the council put the pressure on both sides, I think.
And going forward, it's going to be interesting to see what pressure is next, because right now the only thing FC Cincinnati, we keep talking about construction is underway. Basically, the only thing they can do right now is drive pilings into the ground. They can do deep foundation work. They can't do anything to bring the stadium out of the ground. There's no vertical construction. Everything they're doing, basically, if you see the equipment over there, is they're driving pilings to support the, what will eventually be the stadium. They still need the city to sign off on the final design of the project before they can start vertical construction. And that I think there was a staff, city staff hearing on that this week to begin that process.
Will that go before council, or is that a review board?
I was about to say, the good news for FC is that is not going to council. The final development plan can be approved by the planning commission.
And it will be interesting to see now that they've got the agreement with the tenants. I think they said that that was at the hearing. I think that was Wednesday night was that hearing, that there was no comments about the design of the stadium. All of this was about displacing these tenants on Wade Street and Central Avenue. If that's off the table now, one would assume that would clear things up for that the process to go smoother. Although with FC Cincinnati, it seems like anything that comes up does not go smoothly.
There will be another council vote on the topic. There are actually maybe two. They will need to incorporate the Wade Street property and the Jehovah's Witness property that's adjacent to it into the stadium site, but I don't think they need that to actually go vertical. And they're also going to need a – Mayor Cranley talked briefly about the – problems with the county and the use of hotel tax funds to build, you know, the public infrastructure that is needed around the stadium. That's part of the $50 million that taxpayers will contribute to the project itself. And there's, you know, Sherry reported earlier this week, there's been an issue with that. The mayor said that issue has been resolved, but it will require a council vote on whatever solution they have
and the county concocted. Board that oversees the convention facilities authority. So they like a lot that needs a lot of signing off. But I was actually told last night, I haven't written about it yet, that everybody's like on the same page, which is like, oh, thank God.
That was a quick turnover too, because 3 or 4 days ago it looked like it was another meltdown.
Yeah, that was a surprising headline to see, Sherry, that the situation was bubbling up, and you think, how many more times are we going to be reading something along this?
But I was working on it over the holiday weekend, and my husband walked by, and he was like, is this about the displaced tenants? And I'm like, no, it's all this new. And he's like, what? And I was like, yeah, you can read about it when I publish it.
What? And just while we talked, you know, yesterday the vote ended up being unanimous. I would be stunned if this, when the CFA, the hotel tax money comes back to council, if that's unanimous. I just don't see that happening for that.
Well, there was a, you know, there were at least four votes against it in the first place. So
513-419-7100 is the number to call if you would like to weigh in on this topic today. Why don't we know more about this agreement between the club and the tenants? You would think that after all of the public fighting, that when there was some semblance of resolution, that they'd want you singing it.
Have you ever been involved sometimes with a court settlement? There's always a non-disclosure clause.
Sure.
That we agree to the settlement, but we're not allowed to talk about it. And I think that's essentially, I don't know that it's an actual clause, but FC Cincinnati did not want the terms of the agreement disclosed.
Well, right. And I understand that. And Chris Seelbach, actually, he's the one that made the point. Pretty much everyone in the room where they're like, well, we agreed not to say. Everyone in the room was like, oh my God, what? After a whole day of everything. But you can understand that. David Mann, who's a lawyer, explained that to everyone. That's true. But Chris Seelbach, he was very pointed in his comments, even though he voted for it because the tenants were happy. He is like, that is not for the public good. There's more property up there. You know, there's not more low-income housing kind of around the immediate site. But, you know, he's like, the public good is saying what these numbers are so other people can know. And it can kind of be like this group think and understand who's getting what. And so he did make a good point about that. But, you know, not public.
Hey, Sherry made an important point there too about, and it kind of goes to the road ahead. You know, I don't think there is any more low income housing they could buy in the path, you know, within the general stadium area. So that could point to this going a little easier than it has up until, you know,
but
yesterday.
It just keeps running through my mind. Somebody else told me this yesterday. This has to be a textbook example of how not to do a big project. It's like, there have been roadblock after roadblock.
It's so rushed. It's this 277 days to like get everything together? Because we heard that about like the GM side of things too. Why didn't we have, you know, really somebody overseeing the soccer side? Jeff Birding's been doing, you know, everything. And because everyone was in such a hurry, we just had this groundswell of support. And Major League Soccer is like, you know, we really like you guys. This could be your year, and you have to grab your chance. And the team did that. But it's the shortest of any expansion team window. And so everything has been rushed, and I think that's been part of the problem.
Yeah, I mean, we've had all these stories, a lot of different angles of the story, from the conversation about where the stadium was going to go, and then just lately to have this conversation about the tenants and the team and what's going to happen, and then all of a sudden it's rushed and the ending is here. It's like, what is this, the Game like of Thrones finale?
I don't know. Atlanta, it's like from when we kind of, when they knew 1,000 days of planning. LA, the same thing. Nashville's had a lot more time than us. And so imagine doing all this in 277 days. Although in our lives of covering it, it seems like maybe there's some dog ears involved.
But, and just wait till
but
we
it's
get
not
to,
that long.
And just wait till we get to the point that at some point the team is going to want to buy District 1 police headquarters.
No, you don't say.
And then we're going to get into a fight of what the team says District 1 is worth and what some members of city council and city administration believe District 1
He's
is
totally
worth.
Right. It's to the south of the site, not the north.
Look, well, Cincinnati Public Radio will be moved by then, hopefully, and we won't have to watch that so up close. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The Friday News Review continues now with the latest from Cincinnati City Hall. I'm joined by Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterick. Welcome, Chris. And WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman. Welcome, Jay. Sherry, I'm sorry I didn't say welcome to you that time.
That's fine. You know, you'd think we'd be sick of each other by now. We spent the entire day together yesterday at the longest council meeting ever, but here we are. We love each other.
No, that's not the longest council meeting ever.
Oh, true. All right, fine.
So, Jay, there was a public meeting on the budget this week.
First public hearing. It was Wednesday night on the east side, and there were, it was a surprise to me. I kind of thought that, I usually think that when you go into something like this, 20 or 30 people may sign up to speak. This one had, there were 64 signed up, and I think there were two that left before they got called. So they ended up having 62 people speak on the budget, which for the first hearing, normally as they go on, the attendance goes up. But to have that many at the first one, I thought was pretty impressive.
What seemed to be the general theme of what people were most concerned about or what their big asks were?
Most of them were there, the Center for Closing the Health Gap. The city manager and the mayor eliminated funding for that organization. They were there en masse to ask for funding, and they probably have good reason to be hopeful. David Mann, who chairs the Budget and Finance Committee, after a couple of them said, you know, I think it's the will of the majority of council that funding will be maintained for the Center for Closing the Health Gap. There are also quite a few folks there supporting Larry Falcon, who is the director of the Office of Environment and Sustainability. His position had been eliminated, and he was going to be transferred to Waterworks. Sounds like there's council support that they will find money to maintain his position. And then, per usual, not a whole lot of cuts to Human Services this year. Actually, Human Services funding increased this year, but there were a lot of folks there, you know, asking council to make sure that that goes through.
It was interesting that David Mann gave them an assurance on the health gap. I feel like he's not necessarily been – I think he's compromised on that as a part of things he's wanted in the past, but I guess I thought he was a little skeptical of that.
Yeah, and I think what will be interesting, there's the, you know, zero out to what they had at one time, which I think was, what, $750,000?
Yeah.
I think this year was around six.
Yep.
Right.
So it'll be a, you know, where does the number end up? But I don't think they're going to be zeroed out.
And it sounds like that funding for that health gap situation is going to be resolved or restored.
Yeah, I think it'll be resolved.
Yeah.
And now there'll probably be some showmanship. I mean, last year, council had an agreement to fund the health gap. The mayor vetoed it, even though it had six votes when it passed. I think it had six votes. And, well, yeah, because they overrode the veto. So, you know, he knew it was going to be overrode, but
he did it anyway.
Didn't he compare it to spending in Russia or something? There was some odd remark he made.
The health gap has been a fight for a few years now.
Yeah, it sounds like it's just one of those personal issues between some politicians that, I mean, they may have some political or actual reasons for it, but there are some personal.
That's kind of a great backstory. I mean, the founder of the health gap, Dwight Tillery, the former mayor, was a big supporter of the mayor, Mayor Cranley, in 2013. They had a falling out prior to the 2017 election. Sherry and some other folks, CPO, did some stories about the health gap's effectiveness or lack thereof, and then suddenly, you know, the money was being zeroed out after years of increasing all those years. So
let's get this phone call in before we run out of time. We've got Herschel on the line. Hi, Herschel.
Hey, how you doing?
We're doing well.
So the question is, why aren't you covering the aspect of the Opportunity Zone, which is why FC Cincinnati chose that location, so that the capital gains tax, they can write it off. And as a matter of fact, the Opportunity Zones is where all public housing, or most of public housing, has their plans for the $1 billion plan for rebuilding public housing. So, I mean, the two stories are interconnected, where you're talking about low-income housing. CMHA has a $1 billion plan for low-income housing. And Corporate Cincinnati, which is supporting FC Cincinnati, will be able to take the tax write-off. So that's a story into itself.
Herschel, we appreciate the prompt. We're going to let Chris address that.
Stay tuned to Your Business Courier next Friday. that topic will be addressed, actually. He is right that the stadium is located in Opportunity Zone, and the Opportunity Zones, without getting into the weeds, do allow some very, very generous tax tax breaks, whatever you want to call them. People who sell, sell property, sell businesses, sell assets, can then put them back and reinvest them into businesses or improvements to properties and Opportunity Zones, and they can get basically get a nice tax break on it. We do not know whether that is what is happening in the with the FC Cincinnati Stadium, but we do know that Carl Lindner III, the majority owner, has sold quite a bit of stock recently. Again, we don't know what he's done with that money, the proceeds of selling that stock, but it is certainly a possibility that that is what is going on there.
I will say, I'm sure that's true, but Major League Soccer, this is happening. This is in the stadiums all over the country, which is something that you'll be reading about in the Inquirer next.
Okay, now what are we? Is this a plug off?
These neighborhoods, they're looking for these areas close to the urban core, and there's really not a lot of them. This was mostly vacant property, and they're kind of shoehorning it in, very similar to some of what's going on in other things. And it was like basically the only swath of land close to the urban core.
I mean, it wasn't vacant until they demolished the Stargell Stadium there.
There was Stargell.
You can make it vacant if you tear down everything that's in the zone.
1 minute left.
We're talking about 17 people.
In our last 60 seconds together, we have to talk about Judge Tracy Hunter, right? My goodness. What's the backstory here, and what's the new stuff?
You know what? This case is just, it's been in limbo for a very long time. She was convicted of, giving her brother some confidential court documents to help him. In fact, she was actually charged with a lot more things than that. It came down to just this one charge, and it was this just an absolute circus of a trial and just a lot of drama. That ends up with a 6-month sentence. It goes to federal court for an appeal, a six-month jail sentence, goes to federal court for appeal, and it has been there for 2 years. And finally, the magistrate, I think 2 days ago, was like, you know what, this is it. And he sent it back for sentencing. And it's a different judge because the judge retired. But everyone's expecting that same 6-month sentence to be imposed again in July. But this case has gone on for years.
So will Judge Hunter have to spend these 6 months in the county jail?
It is the county jail, and they've already said that she would be segregated, and now she's appealing that as like that would be a hardship for her. Of course, it'll be interesting really to see if she does serve that time and what kind of caveats are attached to it. Our jail's super full. So I think there could be some early release options there, but we just don't know.
Was she the type of judge in her position who would have been able to send some people to jail?
Well, she was a juvenile court judge.
Juvenile court, okay.
So, and she didn't serve very long before this kind of all unfolded. She was a new judge. And there's a lot of politics behind the idea of people not liking her coming in as the new Democrat in our court system, which was part of this whole drama story.
All right. My thanks to Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederick, and WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman for another exciting edition of Soccer Talk. Appreciate you all being here today on Cincinnati Edition. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.